Alan Greenfield back with us now on Coast to Coast. His latest work is called The Complete Secret Cipher of the UFO Knots. And we're going to talk all about that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Alan Greenfield back with us. He's been interested in the occult, UFOs, strange animal sightings, paranormal occurrences, and phenomena like the shadow people and the real men in black for most of his life. He's been an active investigator since the early 60s. Has traveled the world in search of the truth. Alan has twice been the recipient of the Ufologist of the Year Award of the National UFO Conference. His research and writing has recently centered upon contacting angels and UFO beings by using specific occult spirits, spells, and rituals. Alan, welcome back to the program.
Always glad to be here, George. Thank you for inviting me.
And this is a great job again with the Complete Secret Cipher of the UFO Knots. You've hit another home run.
From what I hear from my publisher, it's selling like hotcakes. But to be honest about it, I think that has a lot to do with, well, it combines Secret Cipher of the UFO Knots with Secret Rituals of the Men in Black. So it's the cheaper way to get both books under one cover. But that isn't what accounts for the enormous sale volume that is going on right now and hopefully will continue. It has a lot to do with the program that the Newkirks and Associates did called Hellier, which first appeared on YouTube and then migrated to one of the premium channels. I think it was Amazon, which...
it was Amazon.
Yeah, and at some point, their work started to do what I was attempting to do when I long ago went down to my hometown in Augusta, Georgia, to write Secret Cipher and Secret Rituals. They were actually written at the same time, but they were published 10 years apart due to the interference of one of the magical orders that I was part of. But I had hoped when it was when Secret Cipher was first published, that people would work with the cipher and make the kind of discoveries that I was able to do by using the cipher, comparing various UFO cases and occult phenomena and cryptids and the whole lot of them, if there was some particular name or word or location that you could convert into the cipher and then convert into the original code book, which is explained in the book. You can predict future events in the same sort of circumstance. But although the book, Secret Cipher, for the edition from Illuminet Press, the late and lamented Illuminet Press, which sort of died under mysterious circumstances, the publisher was died under... really, really strange circumstances.
Really? I mean, was would somebody do him in?
I think so. I've always thought so. His name was Ron Bonds, and he had started out with a BBS back in the early days of computology, if
yes.
I can coin a term, and it was called Illuminet, and that migrated into Illuminet Press, which had a stable of writers, myself included, but also including George Anderson, who wrote several seminal books about UFOs, and Jim Keith, who wrote about both UFOs and I don't know exactly what to call it without seeming to ridicule, which I'm not doing, but sort of the militia black helicopter sort of thing.
Craze,
He was a crossover on that and a friend of mine, and he did a UFO book as well. And even Carrie Thornley, who was suspected as being involved in the JFK assassination, he had written a book about Lee Harvey Oswald before the assassination. So Ron had a really a great stable of writers, and then one by one, not all of them, I'm still here, and I have no idea whether George Anderson is still around or not, but Jim Keith died under very, very suspicious circumstances. Yeah, if you're an old hand at this, you probably knew his name because he did book after book, The Black Helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
He did a book on UFOs, but under a pseudonym. And he was at Burning Man and sprained an ankle, and then he died.
He died from a sprained ankle?
That's what the autopsy says.
Jeez.
Well, I'm not particularly a paranoid person, but at the time, people were calling me and saying, "Alan, you need to kind of watch out because one by one, your stable of writers appears to be dying off under strange circumstances." Then Ron Bonds and his wife went to dinner at a local Mexican restaurant here in Atlanta, and he supposedly died of food poisoning. The thing is, his wife ate the same thing that he did, and she didn't get food poisoning. There were many other patrons in the restaurant, and they didn't get food poisoning. And he died within hours after
ingesting whatever he ate.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way. I've talked to people who know about food poisoning. There are poisons that will kill you instantly, and there are some that are very lingering, but the way he went was not characteristic of food poisoning. It was characteristic of assassination. And, of course, with him went Illuminate Press. Kerry Thornley also died under strange circumstances.
What topics are these people dealing with, Alan, that would be so controversial?
Well, it ranges from the UFOs to cryptids to
the occult.
Borderline occult.
All right.
I mean, I wouldn't say it was hardcore occult stuff, which, you know, I've written on a lot on, but in general, that was not. In fact, it was the leader of one of the ancient orders of antiquity, as they call themselves, that kept me from publishing the second book for 10 years. But maybe that saved my life, in a manner of speaking. But that was not his intent. He said, the magic is respectable, the occult is respectable, but UFOs aren't. And I know a little bit about polling and a little bit about sampling and demographics, and it's just the reverse. I mean, you mentioned the occult. A lot of people think you're talking about Satan or, you know, whatever particular boogeyman people have. But if you mention UFOs, pretty much that has become an accepted thing, at least since the turn of the century. One of the last weekly issues of Life magazine which was in 2000, published a survey which showed that a majority of people thought that UFOs were real, and something like 5% of the population claimed to have had some sort of abduction or contact experience with UFOs. So, you know, this is major stuff, and probably a lot more, quote, respectable than the occult. But in any case, that caused me to put it on hold for some years, and now it's all available under one cover, The Complete Secret Cipher of the UFOnauts.
Well, now, Hellyer, let's talk about that for a second, because that's come up a couple times here. It was done as a documentary series, but was it more like a drama?
No.
And you're in it, too, right?
Yeah, I'm in it, but, you know, I've done, let me give you a sidebar first. I've done a lot of those. I don't do them anymore. A lot of those TV programs that are like UFO Hunters, I did twice, and Brad Meltzer's Decoded. I did when, like, I was on the first episode or the second episode, and I was hesitant because I'm getting on in years, and I was on Ancient Aliens. I didn't want to be thought of as an ancient alien. Huh. But those, as I was speaking to my son, they took me out to Liberty Island to interview me for Decoded, and my son is in show business, and I said, I think maybe I have to join SAG-AFTRA. And he said, well, why? I said, because it's acting. They had me, you know, moving to a mark, expressing, you know, surprise at seeing these people.
Yeah.
And that's at the end of my trip. So, you know, it was a poor quality thing. Hellier, in contrast, I can tell you, having done many, many field investigations, whether it's ghost hunting or UFO watching or interviewing abductees, contactees, whatever, I'm not saying they did no editing, because it's a finely produced...
it's a quality little piece, isn't it?
Yes, yes. People, even that are critical of the content, say that the, you know, the quality of the cinematography, I think it's worthy of that term, and the continuity is just terrific. It's big-time stuff, but it's... it's absolutely authentic. That is the way field investigations go. The good, the bad, and the in-between, which there's a lot of, as anybody who is an honest field investigator will tell you, there's a lot of synchronicities, a lot of things happening that you don't resolve very quickly or perhaps at all, a lot of spooky things, and then... to my great surprise, apparently they were in touch with a guy that I knew slightly back in the, I guess it was mid-1990s, yeah, mid-1990s, who went under a nom de guerre, as he put it, Terry R. Rist. I haven't been on the interviewer side of very many interviews. It's just not my style. But I had...
well, you're on one tonight.
Well, but you're the interviewer. I'm the interviewee.
That's right.
So you ask the questions. In this case, I had to ask the questions. And so I interviewed this guy, Terry. And he, you know, he was basically on the same general page as me, or I thought so at the time. And I also interviewed Carrie Thornley, who, you know, like I said, his story was truly bizarre. Jim Garrison considered him a suspect in the Kennedy assassination.
And, wow, that's a great story.
I was able to sit these people down for interviews, and I, you know, that was my high point in as being an interviewer. Other than that, I've been a guest on all kinds of things, but I like the questions to be to me, not from me. So, you know, that was it. And I tacked that on to the back of Secret Cipher, the interview with Terry.
Now, with Hellier, though, is that based on a true story? Hellier is a small town in Kentucky, right?
Right. And everything, it's not a dramatization. It's the real investigation.
Okay.
Season one is sort of the beginning of it. I mean, you would do better to talk to Greg Newkirk or his wife or, you know, somebody from their crew. All of them are really outstanding people, in my opinion. I got to know them when they came down to, you know, to do the 4 or 5 hours of interviewing with me, which was...
That's intense.
Well, it was extremely intense. I mean, I was sitting in a chair. To me, I look at it and I go, God, am I that old? And then I think, I look like the Godfather in Godfather 1. Hey, Brando.
Just don't collapse Brando, like he did in the rose bushes, right?
No, I don't want to go there. No, I don't want to go there. I'm a survivor, but so far, anyway. More like, we'll make you an offer you can't refuse. That would be more my style. But
sounds like you had cotton balls in your cheek, Alan.
And a script in front of me, because I understand Brando never memorized his stuff.
He didn't have to.
Well,
he could improvise and he'd get it right.
Yeah, well, he also had a script over to the side. If you look at the scenes in Apocalypse Now where he's looking down and holding his head, he's reading the script.
He's reading scripts, huh?
Yeah.
How about that?
Well, he's gone, so I guess I'm not letting any cats out of the bag there.
But Hellier has to do with a paranormal group in Hellier, Kentucky.
No, not exactly. It's a group that is, I think, based in Cincinnati, and they got a note that mentions, if I recall correctly, mentions me and mentions this guy, Terry, and it's from this supposedly really stressed-out guy in Hellier, Kentucky, saying that goblins, or something like goblins, were coming out of an abandoned mine shaft and terrorizing his family, stealing his dog, and he was asking them for help. The weird thing is that the way that they were contacted by this guy, who they have not been able to locate at all.
In real life, they haven't found him?
No, they have not found him.
Interesting.
His house, which they did find, is burned down. And the guy, nobody locally in Hellier seems to have ever heard of him. Of course, he said he was not a local, that he had moved in. There was a mine on his property, and he was... I mean, I don't know if that part of the story is true, but the point is that piqued their interest, if that's the word, because, first of all, it mentioned this Terry Rist person as having suggested that they go to, that this person go to the Hellier group. We'll call them that for convenience. I think they call their organization Planet Weird, and it's well-named. But in any case, it was to an old email address from an old website that they had back when they were teenagers. So the site still existed, and let's face it, on the Internet, nothing ever really disappears. If you can't find it elsewhere, you can go to the Wayback Machine, and you'll probably find stuff that I wrote back in the 60s right, when I couldn't write very well at all. But they had read the early edition of Secret Cipher of the Euphonauts, and they immediately recognized the name Terry Rist, because I tacked as an appendix on the book, which mostly explains how to use the cipher and how it was discovered and so forth. I tacked the interview with Terry on to the end of that. So they got the name, and then that led them to me. And since Greg Newkirk was one of the, I hate the term friends on Facebook, but he's one of my 5,000 Facebook friends. I don't think I have three friends, but, you know, that's just, it's a holdover from the social network days and Mr. Zuckerberg's vast empire of whatever it is. In any case, I consider Greg a friend now. I mean, they got in touch with me and said, "Where's this Terry guy?" And I said, "I haven't seen him since 1995. He made off with my Richard Shaver 1940s pulp magazines. He didn't steal them. They were loaned to him. I went down to Augusta to write my book when I got back. He was gone.
I haven't
seen or heard from him since."
God, is he okay?
They think so, and I'm inclined to think so.
All right, stay with us, Alan. Hold on. We're at the break already. We'll come back and talk more about the Hellier Project and the occult and all these other scary things. Your websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com through your Facebook account. We've got that, and the latest book is called Secret Rituals of the Men in Black. And welcome back, Alan Greenfield with us as we talk about the unusual, the occult, and the very strange, the complete secret cipher of the UFO knots. Alan, secret ciphers generally are secret codes, aren't they?
Absolutely. And I believe that the origin of this cipher is an occult code very similar to some of the Masonic ciphers that existed in the 19th and even in the 18th century. There are earlier ciphers than that, so it goes way back, but this is a cipher that was discovered by a little group in England, the main person being a guy named Jim Lees, who has since passed on, Carol Smith, and Jake Stratton Kent, who had an influence on people on this side of the pond in the order QBLH, which I was a member of back in the day. And they were using this cipher, which they found in the, Aleister Crowley's famous, quote, holy book, unquote, Liber Alba Legis, which, by the way, the letter that the Hellier people got seems to refer to that book, since it says 31, which is what it's Liber Alba Legis, the book of the law, is book 31. And there was another book by his magical son, Friedrich Haad, a favorite of mine, which is also called Liber 31. And 31 has a considerable history as a cipher for a name of God and a name of not. So it's sort of Al and La, Allah, Allah, which is also a name of God in the Islamic tradition. In any case, the cipher was exclusively used for decoding things in occult contexts, and one of its great genius enthusiasts, Tim Kutte, also the late Tim Kutte, told me about it and showed me a computer program that, this is back in the early days of computing, that basically could decipher it automatically. Now there are several sites on the internet where you can decipher the once you understand how it's used, the cipher is available free for nothing on the internet.
Well, why is it used in the paranormal field, Alan?
Well, it's probably that it is Kabbalistic in nature. Ancient Jewish Kabbalah is the hidden wisdom of the Hebrew scriptures, and some Kabbalists believe that there is a code that gives a different set of meanings. That in turn influenced early Greek Kabbalists who used the Greek language. And then, of course, the Book of the Law was written in English, made a point of saying that it was written in English. And this is an English language cipher. But its obvious occult association is it was from what is considered the 20th century's most significant new occult book, the Book of the Law. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that, but that is a commonly held belief, and obviously the people that discovered this were all excited about it. When Kutte brought it to me, I said, well, that's interesting, and I tried it on a couple of occult things, and it worked, but that was not the center of my interest. Some days later, because he gave me a copy of the program, Kutte did, I decided just to try it on some of the weird names that show up in contactee cases, like Al Bender, when he was visited by the Men in Black, was given the word kaik, which had a peculiar spelling, K-A-Z-I-K. So I tried it on that, and it yielded some really fantastic results, including predicting future events, although that were of the same nature. In other words, if it was a UFO case, it would predict other UFO cases. If it was a Man in Black case, it would yield that. well, you don't get any Bigfoot words, you know, but sometimes there's a name of a town or a location or whatever that if you decipher it, it'll tell you basically other towns that have the corresponding number in the same area.
Does it spell it out like a Ouija board?
Oh, no, no, no. A Ouija board, it's more like a number cipher. Sometimes it's mistaken for numerology, but it's not. Numerology is A equals 1, B equals 2, so forth, going through the 26 letters of the English alphabet. But in this case, it's called the Azure-Lidded Woman cipher, which is the predominant one. That means that A is 1, L is 2, W is 3. How that's arrived at is very difficult to describe on the radio, and I hate to say it, but read the book, because it's something that you need the visual on it. But once it was derived, because A is 11 letters from L, is 11 letters from W, and then you go on through the alphabet counting down 11 letters each.
I saw a movie, Alan, an older movie about World War II, and Native Americans were trying to set up their own code so that the Germans could not capture what our messages were. And they had one Native American, and they basically called him a cipher.
Well, because you're talking about the Wind Talkers, the
yes, that's it.
Navajo,
that's
it. Yeah, there are several of them still living. So I wanted to, I mean, when I was, this is a sidebar, but when I was a kid, there were World War II veterans everywhere. I mean, I was in Augusta, Georgia, so that's a military town.
Sure.
And I sort of took them for granted. And now there are not so many. I can only think of two people in public life that were involved in World War II. That was unlikely pair, but Mel Brooks, who's still active, and mm-hmm. Tony Bennett, who's still on the road.
Still doing his thing. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So two or three of the Navajo Wind Talkers are still living. The fact is that they
did a great job.
They used the Navajo language, but then they did substitution. And of course, since they were stationed in the Pacific, the Japanese had no clue. There was no way they could have deciphered that. They probably tried English, and they probably tried other languages.
Yeah.
But I would imagine they never thought of Navajo. So those guys really saved a lot of American lives and are great patriots.
Now let's go back to the occult field here for a moment and tie this in to how it's used to what? Investigate the occult? What is it used for?
To illuminate and clarify occult information that otherwise would be too obscure or not understood.
Or lost.
Or lost, yes. Well, that's actually, that gets into a whole different area. But yeah, I think 99.something% of what we discover about the universe, about the occult, about cosmology, whatever, is lost from the ancient world. And really going back to Sumer and perhaps even earlier than that, the further they dig, meaning archaeologists, the further back they find civilizations. And I suspect, though I certainly can't prove it, not yet anyway, that probably there were sophisticated pre-Ice Age civilizations. And of course, ice having covered pretty much the world, it's unlikely that you're going to come across very much of anything from before that. But there were certainly human beings back then, and we're finding out a lot of very strange things about early humans. So, perhaps influences from beyond as well.
These Hellier goblins that were part of the Hellier documentary, are they real or was that just made up?
No. None of it is made up. I can tell you from direct experience with field investigation, they were fascinated with Hellier from the letter that they got, because
from a guy they haven't found.
It doesn't matter because it was a self-validating thing. I'll get to that.
Okay.
In the 1950s, when Tim Beckley and I were teenage ufologists, there was a case at the other end of Kentucky, interestingly, at the other end of the Mammoth Cave system in Kentucky. There was a case, I don't know if the word goblin really applies, but it was little beings that the press picked up as goblins. In Hopkinsville, Kentucky, one of the most famous UFO cases, this family was besieged by these little beings, and being country folks, they had shotguns and other firearms available and were scared to death. So they began firing, sometimes through their own windows, and they would hit these things, and they would just tumble over and come back. So the Newkirks and Associates, Dana and, Greg, they immediately made that association. That sounds like the 1950s classic case, which was never solved in any kind of natural explanation, if you want to use that term. So they found the property, but the guy, if you read the letters, he wrote them a couple of times, and he clearly was near hysteria. So I suspect he was using an assumed name. I suspect that Terry, which is, I mean, we always assumed that was not his real name. Terry R. Wrist, please, you know, but generally speaking.
Sounds good.
There's a guy who met him long after I saw him who claims that that was his real name, and it was Rice. It was pronounced Rice. But I knew the guy for a couple of years, and he hung out in a circle of people that I was a part of at the time that a lot of people, it's a habit in the cult slash politically radical slash all kinds of, you'd have to be a 1960s person to appreciate it. Everybody had some kind of weird name, a witch name or a nom de guerre or whatever. So nobody thought anything about the name. It was meant to be, I think it was meant to be sort of a joke, because if someone is a terrorist, they're not going to take the name Terry R. Wrist unless they're a very stupid terrorist. And one thing that I know about him was that he was anything but a stupid guy. Anyway, he wandered on. I had loaned him the rocks that Richard Shaver had sent me that are supposedly from an antediluvian civilization, and some letters and a collection of pulp magazines, Amazing Stories, the Ray Palmer magazines from the 1940s. And as it happened, he left Atlanta while I was writing Secret Cipher. So that was the end of my association with him. But his name showing up, and apparently with a live email address, according to the Newkirks, it picked their interest, and they went to Hellyer. They had apparently it's a really little town. I think it's an unincorporated area, actually. They apparently passed the house, saw the mine shaft in the back. But I'm probably garbling the story somewhat. It's well worth watching the two seasons, the five episodes of the first season, and I believe it's 10 of the second. It's an excellent documentary. But there are so many dramatized documentaries and mockumentaries. I've got to tell you, from knowing the people involved and my own involvement in various field research things, there's no exaggeration here. This is straight up. This is the real deal. That's what makes Hellyer more attractive than any of these other programs. And
well, this documentary, I'm sure, put it on the map, didn't it?
It put it on the map, and it put me on a much larger map than I was prepared for.
Really?
Yeah, because people that you if if this happens to you, George, you got to say it on the air, because it's happened to other people that I've done radio programs with, including a guy in Canada. I can't, you know, talk about their specific experiences, but it's like it spreads out these synchronicities that weirdly hive off from the investigation in Hellier and in other related towns that they eventually wind up in. They're besieged by synchronicities. You know, they'll think something, and then that'll be there. Like when they left Atlanta, I said, well, you know, you'll find that you'll know if you're on the path, because something will get in your way if you're not on the path. And they were going down a road to a town in Kentucky, and this is like a couple of hours after they left me, after the long interview there. They get really big points for continuing that day, because I was exhausted.
Hold on, Alan. Let's get more about this episode when we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.